Thanks for downloading the talk show from KERA 90.1 Dallas-Fort Worth. You can learn more and support this program at kera.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the completely redesigned 300-horsepower MDX. More information is available at acura.com.
This is the talk show on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is Dallas a city where doors thrown open for white people are closed or even locked to those of color? Most of us would be ashamed of that assessment, and we might point to the lack of much racial strife in our recorded history as evidence that it's simply not true. But if Dallas had seen a distressing amount of racist activity and racial conflict during the past century and a half, would it be possible for the city's power brokers to conceal it? In his book, White Metropolis, Race, Ethnicity, and Religion in Dallas, 1841 to 2001, University of Texas adjunct history and journalism professor Dr. Michael Phillips argues such a cover-up has indeed taken place throughout a long and deliberate campaign by Dallas's white elite, who feared that any alliance between poor whites and people of color could result in a class revolt. Phillips will speak tomorrow night for the final installment of the 2006 Chautauqua Lecture Series, followed by comments from adjunct SMU history professor Dr. Latrice Adkins, and Dr. Roberto Calderon, Associate Professor of History at the University of North Texas. All three of them are with me today in studio for a discussion of how racial conflict has shaped Dallas. Welcome all of you to the talk show.
Thank you.
Michael, we'll start with you. You call Dallas a city obsessed with whiteness. What does that mean?
Well, the central idea in my book is the idea that race is not anything that's based on biology. It's a socially created concept. The people who've mapped human DNA have found that we're 99.9% plus identical genetically. And so we're talking about a tiny amount of genetic material that accounts for random differences in skin tone, hair texture, whatever. And we've attached a great deal of social importance to those minor differences that have really no biological importance whatsoever. And we've created these categories in humans based on these supposed differences. These categories are random, and the definitions of these categories change. In American society, power, privilege, opportunity have been granted to people who are defined as white. And the definitions of who are white, who are black, you know, what groups belong to these different categories, those definitions have varied widely over time. And the city has used this system of caste privilege, skin color privilege, to divide people who have common economic interests, working class people who are black, brown, and white, and to keep them divided against each other because they assume they have a stake in a power structure that awards them for being white. And so Dallas's elites have depended on that structure for the power because elites are a small group by definition. Wealth is not possessed by many people, sufficient wealth. And so this is the only way if they can make people who are struggling, people who are poor, feel they have a vested interest in the power structure as it exists, and that's the caste system that we have in Dallas today and have always had, then they can maintain their power. So that's essentially what I meant by that.
So if you say that the definition of who was able to regard themselves as white has changed, mm-hmm. Explain how historically in Dallas those changes have taken place and how different groups have sort of been welcomed into the white fold, if you will.
Or white man's club, as I've put it. In the 19th century, for instance, in America, it was commonplace to not regard the Irish as white in the 1840s. That was not so much an issue in Dallas, but in the late 19th century, we began to have a mass migration of people from the northern United States who were of various ethnicities. We began to have people of Jewish descent, people of Eastern European descent, Greeks, Italians, forming communities in Dallas. And of course, after 1910, a large number of people from Mexico began to migrate into the United States after the 1910 Mexican Revolution. And these different groups had various success, varying success in being classified as white. And that became a goal politically for many people because they saw where the wealth, status, and privilege existed, that there was an advantage socially to being classified as white. And in many cases, that inspired an impulse, anti-black racist impulse, because that was part of the ticket of entry. If you bought into the system of white supremacist thinking, and the bottom line was that black human beings were inferior and whites and any other group were superior, then that was one way to win admission into the white man's club, as I put it.
Latrice Adkins, Dallas certainly always has had African Americans who were socially prominent, who had wealth. How did they fit into society throughout the history of the city?
I would base my answer solely on...
Just a second. We're going to get your microphone fixed. Okay. Try one more time.
Can you hear me now?
We're still trying to get you... let's see. She is on mic 4B. We are... okay. Can you maybe come a little bit closer and see if that...
Let's try this.
Okay.
Is that
still not, hold on just a second. Let me see. Oh, okay. Hang on. Okay. Try, 5B. Okay. I'm sorry. One more time.
Okay.
There
working?
We go. We got you. Okay. Yes. Sorry about that.
I read, Dr. Phillips' book. In my comments to him, I mentioned that there is a difference between segregation and separatist sentiment, that the system of Jim Crow, which forced residential segregation based on race, also facilitated the growth of a black professional and business class that provided organic leadership to poorer and working class African Americans. There are cadres of leadership within black Dallas history. If we were going to simplify it, I would say that there are educators, black educators, J.W. Ray, and others who created the alternative, colored is the word we used back then to refer to African Americans, independent schools that facilitated the acquisition of literacy for blacks. In addition to educators, there were preachers. Many of them were itinerant and some illiterate preachers. And then later on, by the turn of the century, there were educated black preachers who led congregations. Their members then were able to access a sense of dignity and decency despite the disappointing realities that were going on in the larger society. In addition to that, there were black business owners, independent businessmen who owned funeral homes, for example. There were several cafeterias. And so what I'm suggesting in my comment that we make a distinction between segregation and separatism is that how African-American communities were able to take advantage of the unfortunate incidents of segregation to build organic leadership and to create pockets of wealth within their own communities. And Dallas has that history. Another problem, quote unquote, with collapsing Dallas history in a vacuum as if this phenomena of Dallas powerful elites controlling and co-opting poorer, less powerful communities, that this is a national phenomenon. It's not unique to Dallas. And as we talk about Dallas's racial history, it's important to keep that kind of contextual relationship. In other words, that wealthy white Dallasites, wealthy white Southerners do not have inherent traits that cause them to be white supremacists, but rather that people internalize belief systems and they perpetuate socialization schemas that they experienced, you know, as they were growing up, that their parents taught them. And so that gives us hope then, because then we can move forward because we can create new schemas, we can create new socialization patterns so that we don't repeat the atrocities of the past.
Actually, I say both of those things in chapter 5 of my book. I talk about how one of the brilliant stories, and one of the inspiring stories in Dallas is that even under Jim Crow, that African-American educators like John Leslie Patton, who was the principal of Booker T. Washington High School, used that opportunity with those underfunded schools to create a curriculum that really created a sense of community and amongst African Americans in Dallas. He actually pursued what today is called Afrocentrist curricula. He had his students reading W.E.B. Du Bois, and he had them reading about the accomplishments of Africans prior to European colonization and slavery. Lessons that were not being taught in white schools. And so John Leslie Patton, as a principal at Booker T during the 20s, 30s, 40s, really was essential in building the community, and that was in the atmosphere of segregation. And I think one of the ironies of Dallas history is that when desegregation did take place, some of the institutions that Black Dallas had created to create that sense of mutual responsibility, to promote a sense of self-esteem and self-respect, got undermined because Black educators were the first to be let go. When white teachers began to teach at the integrated schools, Black teachers were displaced. Black principals were displaced. And Black students were suddenly thrust into a school system in which they were submerged in a world of white racism. And I think that was one of the tragic ironies of the desegregation era. And Dr. Atkins is absolutely correct. There is a difference between separatism and segregation. And in fact, I argue that. And then about Dallas being unique, just real briefly, that's absolutely true too. And I do argue that Dallas is more typical of what happens in the United States than is atypical. It's a fascinating story, though, because this particular place, I think the unity of elites in Dallas is unique, and their ability to manipulate the levers of power in terms of the media, in terms of economic resources, city policy is almost unparalleled in the country. Even a top-down society like Mayor Daley's Chicago back in the 50s and 60s didn't match that kind of total control that I feel like elites had over city politics. So Dallas is unique in that sense, but it did inherit white supremacist ideology from Western history dating back to the time of Columbus.
Roberto Calderon, certainly there is a danger even today in the sort of broader American community and the broader Dallas community, assuming that all Latinos are one sort of monolithic group of people, when in fact you have people who come from a lot of different places with a lot of different levels of English competency for new immigrants as opposed to people who have been here for generations. Have those distinctions always really impacted the way that Latinos thought of themselves here in Dallas as belonging to the greater community or being segmented?
Well, prior to the 1980s and 1990s, when you look at the census for the state of Texas, when we speak of Latinos or in Texas, the word Hispanic being equivalent, we really are speaking about a 90-95% Mexicano, Mexican American community. There really is a sea change demographically within the Latino community in Texas and in North Texas included during the late 80s and the 1990s. One of the statistics I like to point out to gauge how significant that was is that in 1990, still more than 90% of all Latinos in Texas were of Mexican origin or descent. And by 2000, that figure had dropped to 76%, while at the same time, of course, it was the Latino community in the 90s that grew by the largest, not only percentage increase in the state of Texas, but, you know, absolute number. And of course, those Latinos were coming from Central America and South America, from many different countries. So it's an entirely new ballgame. And of course, when we speak of Dallas history and Mexican-American and Latino history, you know, we speak from the perspective also of the most recent event that took place on April 9th here in North Texas of this year, in which 500 here and as many as perhaps 50,000 in Fort Worth persons, primarily Latinos, marched for immigrant rights essentially marching for civil rights, and that's the largest single number. That's the largest civil rights march in all of Southern history, if we put it in that context.
Roberto Calderon, Latrice Adkins, and Michael Phillips are my guests. We're talking about tomorrow night's discussion of racial conflict throughout Dallas history. It will be the subject of the last lecture in the Chautauqua Lecture Series for 2006. We'll take a quick break and take more of your calls and comments in just a minute. This is The Talk Show on KERA 90.1. My name is Chris Boyd. We're talking today about the history of race relations in the city of Dallas and how it has changed and in some ways stayed the same over the past 160-plus years. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send an email to talkshow@kera.org. Would any of you consider the argument that discrimination in Dallas was formed at least as much on socioeconomic status as on skin color? That somehow you could buy your way into being accepted at some point?
Well, I think that's the central part of the story. What I'm going to talk about tomorrow during the Chautauqua's talk at Fair Park is that one of the major stories of race relations in Dallas is within the white community, because like I said, many people who are commonly defined as white in modern 21st century terms were not considered white. And essentially, there was always a socioeconomic element to that, that you saw working class whites begin to be described by Dallas elites in terms that were very similar to the way they described Mexican Americans, Mexican immigrants, and African Americans. And they were perceived as a social problem. They were perceived as a problem, actually, to use the terms of the early 20th century, as a problem of racial hygiene. One of the fascinating things I found researching Dallas history and race relations in Dallas was this phenomena in the early 20th century where they used to hold at Dallas Fair Park Better Baby Contest, where they would actually measure babies' skulls. They would measure their foreheads. They would measure, you know, the angle of their jaws in order to determine whether they were racially fit or not. And this came out of the eugenics movement. And lo and behold, in these contests, the winners were always people who were upper class. And these families, these upper class families, would always describe poor and working class whites in terms of racial inferiority, that these people were genetically inferior and they ought not to be allowed to vote, just like African Americans were not being allowed to vote, because that a republic is only going to thrive if the best and the brightest are allowed to thrive, and that the masses will always vote, you know, according in this way of thinking, will always go for, you know, the worst people, the worst demagogues. And so there always was a deep connection between economic status. In fact, that's the real struggle that's going on with race relations. We use race to talk about class conflict. America likes to pretend that class conflict isn't a central story in American history. We have created that myth by making race the story. But it's, in fact, a story of the poor and the working class versus the wealthy and the powerful.
The problem, however, is when we collapse multiple communities over vast stretches of time to answer your question and have that conversation. In short, no, not anyone and everyone could buy their way into whiteness. So the crisis that white metropolis, I think, is really calling to the centers for people to have a conversation about in terms of racial reconciliation is not a reconciliation between African Americans, Mexican Americans, and white people. It's a conversation for whites, to whites, saying that we've really got to address the crises of how we've constructed our cultural identity. Parents of children who are in school districts that are public and that are very diverse, I think, will will be able to resonate with what I'm about to say next. And that is that in public school classrooms, white children are beginning to internalize some feelings of alienation from the conversation about diversity because their culture doesn't really mean anything. If diversity is understood as different, you're different from me because of X or B, you listen to this kind of music, you speak this kind of language, then we have white children in public school systems who are going through identity crisis, trying to find something that makes them unique. And so then we have teachers and administrators and policymakers trying to address that void without repeating the atrocities of what whiteness has meant in the past. And so in other words, and I'm wrapping up, is that this conversation about reconciliation and this conversation about analyzing how this Dallas power elite were able to create this kind of unique elite control is a really important conversation in terms of reconciling whites to their own cultural identity in the United States. And to collapse and try to add blacks and Mexicans and stir is problematic for me.
I think it's interesting because it does seem as though whites have homogenized whatever their culture was. So it perhaps as a virtue of, you know, if I'm Irish and I want to seem white to the extent that that was acceptable in 1860 in Dallas, maybe you stop, you know, associating with your original traditions. But it is interesting that it seems like in America today, white means sort of one thing, whereas it seems as though there's less diversity within white America.
That was conscious, though, because those ethnic identities were dangerous because they formed possibly an alternative culturally to what was being imposed by the Anglo elites who were on the top. And in fact, the Dallas school system was specifically designed to destroy those specific ethnic identities. I came across a textbook that was given to foreign students, and that's a term they used in the early 20th century in the Dallas School District. And they would read poems basically where, you know, I used to be Polish, I used to be Armenian, I used to be this, now I'm just American. Of course, they don't say what being just American is. There's an assumption that there's something you can define. But whiteness in particular is really defined by what it isn't. It's defined by not being black, by not being Mexican American, by not being a socialist, by not being a believer in community values versus individualistic values. Those are the things that whiteness is defined as. And outside of that, there's no definition of what it is. And I think that's why that sense of alienation that Dr. Atkins is talking about is an issue. Now, it's important to bring Mexican Americans and African Americans into the conversation because, of course, African Americans are the identity that's used as foil that whiteness is defined against. That this is the thing
being white is not being black,
right? Mm-hmm. And so, how do white people perceive black people? And that's an important part of the story. And you know, I think Dr. Atkins, you know, is going to say tomorrow that my book is not a history of African Americans in Dallas, and that's true. It is a history of how white identity was created basically and defined over years and how that identity has changed over time. But if you ignore African Americans and how their actions shaped white attitudes, then I think you're missing a really important part of the story.
Let me clarify. Not ignore African Americans, but put the story in context. For example, Peter Wood in his book Africans in America, Gwendolyn Mitlow Hall in her book Restoring the Links, scholars understand that black people are actually the most American. Almost the majority of black people's roots go back to the Revolutionary period, and the majority of white people in America only go back to the 19th century. We're more American than most Americans in terms of the African ethnicities being linked to American identity. And so if we're going to use blackness as a contradistinctive, as the other side of the dichotomy so that whites can figure out who they are culturally in terms of their identity, then we need a more accurate assessment of blackness in the United States. And I'm sorry, just dropping in black people periodically and strategically in order to create this political discourse is not appropriate and it's not fair.
If I can just jump in, I think it's a great thing that Michael has written this book. I think it provides grounds for a good debate on race, certainly here in North Texas and in Dallas and in Texas history in general. But I would agree you know, with the kind of statement that Latrice is making, I think that even more so than the African-American story in this particular history on whiteness and race in Dallas, the Mexican-American story is even further subsumed and diminished. And it's not entirely Michael's doing, I should say. As someone who is currently working with colleagues and graduate students in North Texas to try and come up with what hopefully will be the first anthology in Mexican-American history on North Texas, we can tell you, and I speak for them and for myself, that this whole question of memory and the record that North Texas institutions in general, whose task has been to capture the memory through the keeping of archives and records, has not done a very good job. And Mexicans have always, been bilingual and bicultural. And one of the requirements, as Michael pointed out, for being white was that you had to become not only other than black, but you had to become culturally Anglo-Saxon or as close to that ideal as possible. And certainly Mexicans, many of them having the question of color before them as well in terms of phenotype, couldn't necessarily walk down that path.
Would they have wanted to?
And many of them didn't even want to. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting absences in this history, where Mexican American history is concerned, is the total absence of any discussion of Mexican electoral participation in the city of Dallas, totally and completely, except for when you begin to get toward the end of the book. But in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s, essentially Mexicans are outside the game. But we know from reading Texas history and Southern history and the history of the Southwest, certainly in Texas, Mexicans are part, are subjected to the white primary, white man's primary, are subjected to the poll tax, and are essentially excluded very effectively, as is the African-American community, from being able to bring themselves to be part of the electoral history. And it isn't a surprise that the first congressman elected of Mexican-American descent from Texas, Henry B. Gonzalez of San Antonio, who was also the first state senator elected in 1957 and whom Michael does mention in his book, was when he first came to Congress in 1961, one of the first things he proposed that the poll tax be undone, and it was.
The book that everyone keeps bringing up is called White Metropolis: Race, Ethnicity, and Religion in Dallas, 1841 to 2001. My three guests will all discuss that book tomorrow night at Fair Park in the final installment of the 2006 Chautauqua Lecture Series. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and the email address is talkshow@kera.org if you'd like to join the conversation. Let's talk to Ron in Arlington. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I was just calling. I just had a real quick question. I keep hearing Mexican-American, African-American, and then white people, and it seems kind of, I don't know, like some, there's kind of a contradiction there. Seems like that you're kind of leaving a wide open space, you know, there, you know what I'm saying?
Are you talking about the classification of
yeah.
Okay, let's see
you
if
know,
you can.
Like, I mean, I'm born in America and I'm white, and I mean somewhere down the line I have German blood in me. I have English, you know. I don't say that, you know, call myself German American or German English, you know, or something like that. I'm just an American, regardless of the color of my skin. I don't see why you should call somebody African-American or Mexican-American just simply because, well, that's the color of their skin. A lot of these people have never lived in Africa or Mexico.
Okay, Ron, thank you very much for your call. I think we've got your point, and I appreciate that. Okay. In fact, Michael, I know that you argue for a colorblind America. Is that even possible?
Well, that's not exactly true. You know, it's a historic reality that African Americans and Mexican Americans and Anglos, which has become the blanket term for people of various ethnicities who are white, have had different historical experiences and were shaped by those different historical experiences. So you have to acknowledge that past, and you have to honor much of the differences that have occurred because of that. However, what I want to dismantle, what I want to end, is a political system that rewards people for their conformity to that supposed white ideal. And that's a cluster of behaviors about politics, about community, about the human destiny, the human family. The idea that white culture, white society is superior. I mean, we're seeing an exercise of that in Iraq today, that we are the people who are supposed to bring light and democracy to the world because we have the superior culture and the superior religion. I want to dismantle that set of assumptions, and I want Americans who are labeled as white to realize that this is totally an artificial identity, and that if the identity can be created, it can be dismantled in the future. But you have to acknowledge the history that led up to that. And talking about the listener's call, the reason that, the struggle that we're talking about with white racial identity, what he's talking about is the end product of that. He was, people were encouraged to disappear into this homogenous mass because they were people who were identified as white were encouraged to believe that they had a vested interest in oppressing black people, that black people were a threat. And Dr. Atkins, I think, is unfairly characterizing my book about in regards to African Americans. I have in this book, one of the major themes is what African Americans do in response to that and the identity they create. And it's an identity they carry with them from Africa, but they also create in response to white supremacy. From the very beginning, African Americans were seeing the hypocrisies of white America, seeing Christian slave owners who, raped slave women and who sold and broke up families. And they critiqued that and they saw the immorality of that. They saw the results in the cities and the factories of greed and capitalism at its worst. And they critiqued that. And they created, and I use in particular when I'm talking about that generation of educators in the early 20th century, how they created an alternative view. And you see this in the civil rights movement, the idea of the beloved community, a community that acknowledges different racial past, but also sees a destiny in which the society could step outside of color identity and could create a human identity instead.
The problem that I'm pointing out, which Dr. Phillips calls an unfair characterization of the book, is that that history, what black Americans were able to do because of and in spite of white supremacy, is long, complex, non-conforming, and it cannot be treated as a side story over 160 years erratically. And that's what I see happening in the book. And I have a problem with that. But I don't have a problem with his goal. We have the same goal, and that is to not repeat the mistakes of Dallas's racial past and to move us forward. And that's what I'd like to underscore. We share the same goal.
We'll take a quick break and be back with our discussion of Dallas's racial history. The telephone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email talkshow@kera.org. Tomorrow on the talk show, Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz. He's well aware of the increasingly negative modern view of globalization as a source of economic and social inequality, but he argues that truly free trade can yield higher living standards and more stable governments throughout the world if it's done right. We'll find out what he means by that tomorrow at noon. Next week, I'll be recording interviews with U.S. Senate candidates Kay Bailey Hutchison and Barbara Ann Radnofsky. Because of the way their schedules have worked, we won't be able to speak to them live during the talk show or take your calls, but we would like you to participate. So if you'd like to submit a question for those interviews that are coming up next week, feel free to email kboyd@kera.org. Please put Senate in the subject line. The talk show page of kera.org has more information about our upcoming show topics. While you're online, of course, you can always sign up for our free daily podcast. You never have to miss an episode of the talk show that way, and you don't need an iPod to listen. Returning once again to today's discussion of race and the history of the city of Dallas, we welcome your calls at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email talkshow@kera.org. Let's talk to Keith in Irving. Hi, Keith. Hi, Keith. Are you with us?
Yes, I sure am.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
It seems to me the conversation today is really about victimization, about in a world where the black and white divide is getting smaller, we have to maintain and reinforce this idea of victimization so the Democrats and socialists can maintain control of those folks and keep them voting Democratic. I think comments off the air. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks. Anybody want to take that?
I think that reveals actually a misunderstanding of history and historical processes. One of the things I found amazing is I encounter a lot of white people today who will dismiss the significance of racism today. And they will dismiss the significance of historical racism. I've had people say, well, you know, I mean, the Civil Rights Movement happened. The Voting Rights Act passed in 1964. And black and brown people are still complaining. What's the deal? And I find that amazing because, of course, immediately after desegregation, immediately after the Voting Rights Act, we had the phenomena of white flight from the suburbs. White people were so indoctrinated into fearing black and brown people that they fled urban centers where black and brown people lived, went to the suburbs, created gated communities later to avoid contact with African Americans and Mexican Americans. And they took their tax dollars with them. And they undermined urban schools. They undermined urban governments with the drain of the tax dollars. So we've never escaped the legacy of racism. Legally, the barriers have come down. And I mean, it is significant, for instance, in Jasper, Texas, when that unfortunate lynching and tragic lynching took place, that the men who committed the deed were actually convicted. 30 years ago, that might not have happened. That is a significant difference. But nevertheless, we live in a world that is, I feel, no less racist than we lived then.
Well, is there, though, is there a danger in studying racism in that it does in some ways perpetuate the attitudes that have existed and caused problems in the past? Or is this something that always yields something positive if we try to bring the conversation to the forefront?
I would say that it depends on the teacher, the leader, the pastor, the parent, the friend that puts it into context. For example, across the United States, people are grappling with the idea of reparations or apology. Most recently in Waco, they decided to commemorate a lynching. And then they asked various pieces of the Waco, Texas community, how do we acknowledge the horrific event and with a sense of ownership that it's a part of us, but it doesn't define who we are now. And I think that's important. Bank of America is one of our financial institutions who has opened their records in terms of trying to find out, do they have a slave past? And then make remuneration, if you will. So there's nothing that I, sitting here, black as I am, and I'll be black forever, can do about slavery, do about what happened in Jasper. There's nothing I can do about that. But what I can do is in the classroom, and if I ever do get married, plug, and have some kids, I can raise children who are socially conscious and who are culturally aware and who are spiritually prepared to be open and create a new kind of society.
What makes this conversation so hard for us to have as Americans? Because I have you here are three academics, three PhDs, and it's still not an easy conversation to have. I think a lot of people without the sort of communication tool for saying things in a way that others can understand are almost afraid of the discussion outside of their own ethnic group.
But the city of Dallas does the dining table every year. Our city, I understand that we have these challenges, but our city has made attempts to really bring people to the table to have conversation. The whites only signs above the water fountain at the Dallas Records Building, I think it was downtown, we began to ask communities, well, what do you think should be done about the signs? And so we have the dining table every year. We have the Martin Luther King luncheon every year. We have opportunities for communities in East Dallas, South Dallas, North Dallas to get together, however uncomfortable it is, and begin that kind of discourse and reconciliation. Dallas is doing it.
I think one of the things that makes this an important conversation and a conversation that people can't necessarily come together on, at least not on all points, is that history is very much alive. Dallas continues to change. North Texas continues to change. The nation, the state continues to change. And I'm talking about the population. In fact, there's a lot of discussion in this history by Michael's history on whiteness in Dallas that has to do with population change. And that is an ongoing process. History doesn't stop. I think that's what Michael was also saying about his students just a while ago. History doesn't stop just because you're the one who's currently occupying a place in it, as we all are. So the conversation continues, and it's not always easy. And it isn't necessarily about victimization. And you know, one of the things that I like to say that is interesting about our own or again referring to the Mexican American history part of this is the that discussion on lynching, for instance. When Michael talks about lynching and cites some sources, he talks about Texas had 500 and some lynchings within a specified period of time, late 19th, early 20th century. And I was impressed by the fact that he mentions Anglos were lynched, and they were. Whites, I think he says, and African Americans were lynched, but you know, it's as if Mexicans weren't being lynched in Texas. And of course, that the Plan de San Diego in right. far south Texas took place, and there anywhere from 500 to as many perhaps as 5,000 Mexicanos, men, women, and children were taken down essentially by officers of the law and vigilante committees. It's an important book, but there it has its lapses.
1-800-933-5372 is the telephone number. Let's talk to Paul in Dallas. Hi, Paul.
Hello. How you doing?
Great.
How
thanks.
You guys doing today? I'm on my way to Fort Worth, but I'm a native Dallasite, and I just wanted to call and ask everyone at the table. And I have a problem with. You guys are saying.
Paul, hang on one second. You broke up. You have a problem with what? Say it again.
With everything that's being said. As far as putting things in context, encapsulating things, in order to look at this objectively, we've got to look at further than 300 years out. We have got to look at something along the lines of at least 5,000 or 6,000 years. I mean, there was a time when we were the big kid, and at least in our region, at black people, we were the kind of the big government, the builders of the pyramids, and we had the status symbols. And if you wore Egyptian sandals, you were on top of everything, and you had slaves. So, my question is, when are we going to get beyond this, and what mindset takes us to the next level, to where I can see another human being for the virtue or the threat that he really is, which is genuinely going to be based on his mind, his character.
Well, Paul, let me interrupt you. Before we put this question to our panelists, what do you think it takes?
I don't know. I really don't. I'm calling to ask. I really don't know. I'm 41 years old. I'm not an academic, but I've been through a lot of things in life, and I've lived a good life. It's a wonderful life. I love it.
Well, I think
I just don't know.
I think maybe we're all looking for the same answer. Let's see if we can pose this to all of our panelists. Thanks for your call.
Well, let me suggest one thing that's not an answer, and that's not talking about the historical reality of racism. Other countries have tried that. In fact, the United States tried it for most of, when I was in school in the 1960s and 1970s in Texas, the mention of African Americans and Mexican Americans was almost non-existent. And we certainly, Civil War wasn't even taught as an issue about slavery. It's taught as a there were different economic systems between the North and the South, and that's supposedly what caused the Civil War. All sorts of – there was a – and I used the pun intentionally. It was a whitewash of history, and we see this in in the British occupation of Ireland, the attempt to eradicate Irish identity and to erase any mention of the English conquest of Ireland, the brutality of that. In Turkey today, with laws that make it an insult to Turkishness to talk about the Armenian genocide, that is not a solution. That only deepens divisions, and the reality contradicts the myth that's being promoted. You have to address those. Part of becoming a more humane person is being conscious of the oppression that has taken place in the past and how that's corrupted society. And in the end, harmed everybody. One of the things I tried to argue in this book is that that surely African Americans and Mexican Americans were the people who suffered the most because of racial ideology in the United States and in Dallas. However, whites victimized themselves with that ideology. They lost the potential, the talents, the abilities of members of the white or of the black and the brown communities. They lost access to their ideas, their thoughts, their passions because they segregated them and they shut out their voices in community decision making. And poor whites ended up as political detritus just like African Americans and Mexican Americans, and they hitched their wagon to the idea that their white skin was going to give them privilege, and they ended up as powerless as their black and brown neighbors. Everyone was victimized by that. And unless you're conscious of that, because the process recreates itself, and like Dr. Calderon said, it's an ongoing process, and we see it with the discussion of the immigration debate today. This is the focus of racism now, is immigration. And I see the same process of people who are already disempowered feeling powerful if they can use their American identity to identify themselves against these immigrants, that the same process is ongoing. And the white community is not going to gain what it thinks it's going to gain by its white or by forgetting the racist past.
Latrice Adkins, you mentioned earlier that there are forums in this part of the country where people can come together and
That's
talk
true.
About these issues. What do you see as the best signs of progress in the past few decades?
Well, there's a problem with the word progress. Positive change might be a better word. Positive change or transformation might be a really great way. So positive change, transformation. I think it's called the Dallas Dinner Table. We do it at the beginning of every year, like January or so, right around Martin Luther King's birthday. And different community institutions, churches, temples, community development organizations just open up their doors. The organizers pose one central question. We all, you know, kind of talk about that question. The Dallas Ministers Alliance out of South Dallas and the other community-based organizations many times sponsor events and invite people to have conversations. But perhaps the best way to affect this kind of positive change is in a very, very simple residential way where households, moms and dads and brothers and sisters, they begin to embrace their entire history and their entire identity. And I think, as I said during the break, that is the strength and brilliance of Michael's book. He says that whites in Texas are Southern, whites in Texas are of the West, whites in Texans are in Dallas are Texans, they are Irish, they're all those things. And being able to explore that and embrace that would be very healthy. The last thing I'm going to say is the other parts of the book, those that Michael says I unfairly characterized, I'm trying to be very critical and academic in saying none of that is new for Black history or Black America. The impact of racism on Black communities, that's not new knowledge to us. What it did to poor white people, that's not new knowledge to us. How it caused whites to develop what he calls the collective mental illness, which is racism, that's not new to us. And so that's not new knowledge or new information. What would be novel for us is seeing then whites begin to coalesce in their own communities and say, we want a healthier culture. We want America to really mean what it should. And so when someone calls in, like our first caller that says, I'm just American, we will all at one point in the lofty future be able to have a consensus and say, yes, that's what we all are. And that's a good thing.
Dr. Latrice Adkins, Dr. Roberto Calderon, and Dr. Michael Phillips all will appear tomorrow night at 7 at Dallas Heritage Village's 2006 Chautauqua Lecture Series at Fair Park's Hall of State Auditorium. That's a debate and a discussion on Dallas's racial history. That event marks the final installment of the lecture series. You can get more information at dallasheritagevillage.org. Thanks to all three of you for joining
us.
Thank
you. Thank you.
Jeff Whittington produces the talk show. Jeannie Mascoro is our engineer. Sean Fitzpatrick screened phone calls today. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.